Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The best-selling book, Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, was published 3 years ago, but it still stirs up strong opinions here in Appalachia.
J.D. does paint a certain part of the culture, but it's not the total culture. But you'll find most local Native people won't read the book. They've lived that life.
He's not from this area, even though his family is. He's never really lived in this area, so I don't feel like he really has a leg to stand on.
So should we be so quick to dismiss J.D. Vance's story?
To me, it is a fairly accurate portrayal of his family. And if you look at the book, it says it is a family memoir. There are other families like that in our community. There are other families like that in Appalachia. But it doesn't represent the entirety of the Appalachian experience.
A new book called Appalachian Reckoning, A Region Responds to Hillbilly Elegy, compiles the writing of 40 people who respond to J.D. Vance. Why do so many people feel he missed the mark in his portrayal of our region? That's ahead. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The book Hillbilly Elegy was on the New York Times bestseller list for 24 weeks. It's a personal memoir by J.D. Vance, who grew up in the Rust Belt town of Middleton, Ohio. His family originally hails from Appalachian, Kentucky. He pronounces it Appalachia, by the way. Listeners of our show know that I pronounce it like Vance's Kentucky family says it. Appalachia, like throw an apple at ya. Okay, you may be saying, why after 3 years are we still talking about Hillbilly Elegy? Well, after the 2016 presidential election, some people who have never lived or spent time in Appalachia read Hillbilly Elegy, hoping it could explain the region. The book sold more than 1 million copies, and a Ron Howard film is now in the works, which means the story will reach an even wider and perhaps different audience. So the book is still having ripple effects. For those who don't know Vance's story, here's a quick summary. Like so many other families from Appalachia, Vance's grandparents and mother migrated to the Rust Belt in search of work. But for most of his childhood, he often visited his mama and stayed in their family holler in Jackson during the summers. As an adult, Vance eventually moved to Silicon Valley, where he worked for an investment company. He's now investing in startup projects as a venture capitalist. We'll hear more about that later in our show. In Hillbilly Elegy, Vance explores his family's Appalachian roots. He describes his neglectful upbringing, his mother's drug addiction, and his mama's tough love. While the book is called a memoir and describes Vance's unique personal story, it's more than that. He also described it as a reflection on a culture in crisis. He doesn't skirt around judgment, and at times he seems to have a scornful tone, or maybe shame, for the world he comes from. Here's an excerpt in which J.D. Vance talks about some of the people he encountered while working at a tile factory in Middleton, Ohio.
$13 an hour was good money for a single guy in our hometown. A decent apartment costs about $500 a month, and the tile business offered steady raises. Every employee who worked there for a few years earned at least $16 an hour in a down economy, which provided an annual income of $32,000, well above the poverty line even for a family. Despite this relatively stable situation, the managers found it impossible to fill my warehouse position with a long-term employee. By the time I left, three guys worked in the warehouse. At 26, I was by far the oldest. One guy, I'll call him Bob, joined the tile warehouse just a few months before I did. Bob was 19 and with a pregnant girlfriend. The manager kindly offered the girlfriend a clerical position answering phones. Both of them were terrible workers. The girlfriend missed about every third day of work and never gave advance notice. Though warned to change her habits repeatedly, the girlfriend lasted no more than a few months. Bob missed work about once a week, and he was chronically late. On top of that, he often took 3 or 4 daily bathroom breaks, each over half an hour. It became so bad that by the end of my tenure, another employee and I made a game of it. We'd set a timer when he went to the bathroom and shout the major milestones through the warehouse. 35 minutes, 45 minutes, 1 hour. Eventually, Bob, too, was fired. When it happened, he lashed out at his manager. How could you do this to me? Don't you know I've got a pregnant girlfriend? And he was not alone. At least 2 other people, including Bob's cousin, lost their jobs or quit during my short time at the tile warehouse. You can't ignore stories like this when you talk about equal opportunity. Nobel-winning economists worry about the decline of the industrial Midwest and the hollowing out of the economic core of working whites. What they mean is that manufacturing jobs have gone overseas, and middle-class jobs are harder to come by for people without college degrees. Fair enough. I worry about those things, too. But this book is about something else. What goes on in the lives of real people when the industrial economy goes south? It's about reacting to bad circumstances in the worst way possible. It's about a culture that increasingly encourages social decay instead of counteracting it. The problems that I saw at the tile warehouse run far deeper than macroeconomic trends and policy. Too many young men immune to hard work. Good jobs impossible to fill for any length of time. And a young man with every reason to work. A wife-to-be to support and a baby on the way, carelessly tossing aside a good job with excellent health insurance. More troublingly, when it was all over, he thought something had been done to him. There is a lack of agency here, a feeling that you have little control over your life, and a willingness to blame everyone but yourself.
That's J.D. Vance reading the introduction from his book Hillbilly Elegy, courtesy of HarperCollins Audio. Positive reviews of Hillbilly Elegy have been published in newspapers across the country. One reviewer for the L.A. Times wrote, J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy provides a window into the pain and anger of Trump's America. On the other hand, critics of Hillbilly Elegy accuse Vance of claiming that most people are lazy without addressing the root causes of poverty here in Appalachia. They also object to the use of the word elegy in the title. An elegy is usually a lament for the dead, and some who identify as a hillbilly felt Vance is saying Appalachia is dead or dying. Today we're going to explore how some people here in Appalachia are still reacting to this controversial book. If you think everyone in Appalachia feels that J.D. Vance's memoir has brought nothing but shame, you're wrong, as you'll hear in just a bit. We'll also listen back to my interview with Vance from just after the book's release in 2016. Since then, reactions have been so heated that several books have been written in reaction to Hillbilly Elegy, including a new book from West Virginia University Press called Appalachian Reckoning, A Region Responds to Hillbilly Elegy. It's a collection of writing by 40 different contributors, most of them challenging J.D. Vance's take on Appalachia. But the book also explores the larger issue of how this region and the people who live here are stereotyped. One of the editors for Appalachian Reckoning is Anthony Harkins, a professor of history at Western Kentucky University.
People outside the region who read Hillbilly Elegy and maybe felt like, you know, that was the definitive voice about the region will have a more complicated perspective after looking at this book.
Many of the essays in Appalachian Reckoning are quite academic, but there are also essays, poetry, and photography from activists, artists, and poets. In fact, information on Inside Appalachia was even mentioned in the book as a resource given to attendees at a discussion about Hillbilly Elegy. Much like Appalachia, there's not a single way of thinking. The 40 writers and artists in this book all have their own perspectives. We'll hear from the other co-editor of this book, as well as some of the contributors, in just a bit. First, let's hop over to Jackson, Kentucky, where J.D. Vance calls home, although he didn't spend all his time there. Here's what several people in downtown Jackson had to say about Hillbilly Elegy.
I think that it is factual, the coverage of the area. Those of us who've always lived here, we're just kind of numb to it, but viewed from a national perspective, it can be rather shocking to people.
I read the book. I didn't read it as a social book, you know. I read it as just following the events of how life was and how things were in Jackson at that time. I didn't really get the big social picture that was drawn from it later on and what it came to, I guess, represent.
J.D. does paint a certain part of the culture, but it's not the total culture. But you'll find most local Native people won't read the book. They've lived that life.
To me, it is a fairly accurate portrayal of his family. And if you look at the book, it says it is a family memoir. There are other families like that in our community. There are other families like that in Appalachia. But it doesn't represent the entirety of the Appalachian experience.
He's not from this area, even though his family is. He's never really lived in this area, so I don't feel like he really has a leg to stand on.
Those were some voices of people who live in Breathitt County, Kentucky, giving their opinions on the book Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance. Thanks to reporter Sydney Bowles with the Ohio Valley Resource, WMMT, and Apple Shop for collecting those interviews for the show. No word yet on whether any parts of the Hillbilly Elegy movie will be filmed on location in Jackson or even in Appalachia, though there were reports last year that the director and Vance did visit Jackson, Kentucky together. Up next, an Appalachian poet responds to J.D. Vance, and another writer explains why she doesn't think we should be so quick to reject Hillbilly Elegy. That's coming up Inside Appalachia.
Sitting in the screen room digging for slate. It's hot when it's summer. It's cold when it ain't. Tracks. The cold train crawls like a snake long and black. Two tall spires through the low-hanging clouds. It's all I can see. My dirty cold town.
Stay connected with me and the Inside Appalachia team and find out what's cooking behind the scenes when you sign up for our email newsletter. Catch up on what you may have missed or see what's ahead. Sign up on our website, wvpublic.org, to find out more.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today we're doing something a little different. We're spending the entire show talking about one book, Hillbilly Elegy, and hearing some of the reactions to the book from people across our region because, well, our story's complicated. For a lot of people who aren't from here, Hillbilly Elegy has become the definitive book on Appalachia and the working poor. And it's even been selected as summer reading for some colleges and universities for students in the U.S. Intense interest in our region has come and gone over the years for many reasons. This latest round would probably not have emerged had it not been for the result of the 2016 presidential election. While Trump won a lot of support in many other areas, Appalachians generally favored Donald Trump in that race by a wider margin than most. But it doesn't give the whole picture. Before the break, several people from eastern Kentucky shared their opinions of Hillbilly Elegy. We also heard about a new book called Appalachian Reckoning, where many different writers published responses to Hillbilly Elegy. One of those writers is Appalachian poet Crystal Good. Good has read her poems around the world. Here she is reading the poem she contributed to Appalachian Reckoning.
He said, she said. He doesn't speak for me. He doesn't know me. He is Scots-Irish. He is not Appalachian, Mama said. He can't even spell it. He likes to talk about himself, too much about himself. Mama said, that's normal in the Rust Belt. We aren't sure where he is from. He is a memoir. He is a bestseller. He went to Yale Law, y'all. He is fight or flight first class. He takes out white trash and Black Lives Matter bags. He is not a redneck. Mama is a redneck. Mama always has her red bandana on. He didn't vote for the welfare of Miss Appalachian Queen. He has class mobility. He parks his car at the White House. He doesn't have any bumper stickers. Mama said that's a lie. He has won Trump. He doesn't drive a Subaru. He has a vanity plate. Make America great again. He is punctual, right, and on the times. He goes to the movies with Opie. He was a gift. Mama said I better get to the library if I want to read that crap. She won't let he come in the house. He was already checked out. He came in the mail. My wrench uncle sent. He is a lawyer. He loves his mama. I love my mama too. She is mountain wise. She just tricked me to read he, Hillbilly Elegy.
That was Crystal Good reading her poem He Said, She Said from the book Appalachian Reckoning. Good says that her reaction is fueled by the deep history we have here in Appalachia of being misunderstood. We've been dealing with negative stereotypes for a long time, outside Appalachia and inside too.
I was at the launch of Appalachian Reckoning at WVU a couple of weeks ago. There was over 200 people there. And I was stunned at the questions that the audience was asking. I really thought this would be my people. This would be an audience that, you know, got the book and the questions. It would be a lot more rah-rah. It was very defensive. It was sort of defending again, meaning some of the questions that stick out to me were this one man stood up and said how much he appreciated the Appalachians because – Appalachians, I do believe he said, because, we don't need much. We really don't mind working for $10 an hour. And he has a fella that works for him. And it was sort of like my mouth was open. And then one lady stood up and asked a question. Well, isn't there an Appalachia everywhere? It just opens up the defensiveness that I think is a characteristic of many people that are quote-unquote feel the need to defend the region. And I think that's what this book in part is doing.
Good says she thinks the people of Appalachia should be more involved in telling their own stories. But she also says some good has come from hillbilly elegy.
I got to give a shout out to J.D. Vance because I'm getting poems published. I'm getting asked to speak. I'm getting asked to, you know, do things because of the work that he put out. You know, and then there's an entire anthology. You know, there are entire books coming out in response to his book. So what that tells me is that, you know, maybe we need to think of how instead of constantly being, it just highlights the region's defensiveness, fatalismness, I guess, and that it is really a time to create the narrative instead of combat the narrative.
J.D. Vance isn't just a writer. Although he came from modest means, he went to Yale Law School and now manages a venture capital firm called Rise of the Rest. The firm is a sponsor of different initiatives across the country, including App Harvest, a farming cooperative in Appalachia. App Harvest sponsored a TEDx event that happened in Corbin, Kentucky last month. TEDx is a nonprofit organization that enables innovators to share their ideas in the form of short, informative talks that cover a range of topics. Good was a speaker at the TEDx in Corbin. When she found out about J.D. Vance's indirect involvement, she was caught off guard.
I participated in TEDx Corbin, which is in Corbin, Kentucky, which is a cute little town. I'd never been there. You know, I thought, well, okay, this may be a good spot to host a TEDx. It's the beginning of something, and I did two performances there, and then on the next day, you know, I was like, hey, it's time to get up and go home, and then it was brought to my attention. Well, how do you feel about J.D. Vance being one of the sponsors of the event? And I thought this was a joke. I mean, surely this is a joke. You're trying to get or a little rile out of me. But in fact, J.D. Vance, his investment company, invests in a company called App Harvest. They were the primary sponsor for the event. You know, I had to sit back and think about that. I had a nice drive home to process that.
And even though she's not a huge fan of J.D. Vance, Good points out that his story is his own, and he's entitled to tell it.
Here's a person. He's a person. Like, I get upset when I get put in certain boxes or certain labels get put on me or, you know, and I think, I don't even know this J.D. Vance. So to me, I had to kind of take a pause there, too. We've made a villain out of a human being for creating a book, you know, that is their story, is clearly labeled memoir. We're mad. In a sense, use mad in parentheses, that it has gotten so much recognition. You know, he just happened, you know, if you think, you know, happened to be the person, right, for the success to be dropped on or blessed, if you like, whatever word you want to use. And so then he becomes the villain. When I can start to see sort of this machine around the book, right? And maybe it's the machine that we need to look around. I mean, you know, look at the books that become a New York Times bestseller list. Look at the books, you know what I'm saying? So is it J.D. Vance or is it the machine around, you know, how, whether it's a book or a movie or whatever it is that gets, you know, influenced into, you know, popular cultures.
That was poet Crystal Good reflecting on J.D. Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy, and how other people have reacted to the book. We've talked before about Central Appalachia's transitional economy, and as coal jobs continue to decline, it's not clear what, if any, will take its place. We've met some creative, talented craftsmen and engineers from this region who usually create things on a small scale because of the limited startup resources they have. Recently, Vance used his connections in Silicon Valley to bring potential investors into the region for a bus tour. As Jeff Young reports, Vance's tour is attracting hopeful companies and some harsh critics.
Vance worked with AOL founder Steve Case to line up big-name investors for what they call the Rise of the Rest. So who are the rest? Well, Vance says it's anyone outside the Silicon Valley, Boston, and New York tech centers, the places that take up about three-quarters of venture capital investment.
And so to us, the rest is pretty much everybody that's struggling over that really small pot of money. If only three states are getting most of the venture capital, that means only three states are getting most of the net job growth.
The tour's real purpose is to raise visibility for entrepreneurs in places that the economic recovery has largely left behind.
And we don't think that Rise of the Rest is going to solve the economic development problem for the entire region. We just think, and we have a lot of confidence, that it will help.
Since Vance's memoir about his dysfunctional family hit the bestseller list, he's become a go-to explainer for all things Appalachian. But Vance is also attracting critics who say he blames the poor for their own predicament. When Vance spoke at a recent Appalachian Studies conference, some audience members turned their backs in protest. Vance is taking the criticism in stride.
I definitely think people are justifiably a little bit weary of having one guy serve as a representative of the region.
Others have concerns about whether the venture capital Vance now promotes is the right fit for the region.
This is a place where investors have shown up time and time again, and they left behind a mess.
That's Dee Davis, founder of the Center for Rural Strategies in Whitesburg, Kentucky. Davis compares venture capitalists, with the high rate of return they often seek, to the extractive industries that damaged so much of his region.
We'd love to have some thoughtful investment, some patient investment, some people who can understand what's really valuable here.
One early investment by Vance's Rise of the Rest Fund could speak to some of those concerns. The company App Harvest aims to build large hydroponic greenhouses on abandoned mine land in eastern Kentucky. App Harvest founder Jonathan Webb spoke to partner station WMMT.
Now is the time to reimagine, reinvest, and rebuild here. What are we going to do now?
App Harvest has lofty goals to put damaged lands to new use, but it has hit a snag. The uneven settlement of the disturbed mine site could make some of it unsuitable for construction. Another example of how hard it could be for new investment to gain a solid footing in Appalachia's hills. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Jeff Young.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I interviewed J.D. Vance on Inside Appalachia just after Hillbilly Elegy was published in 2016. We reached back out to him to see if he had anything to say about the new anthology, Appalachian Reckoning, a written response to his memoir, but he didn't respond. So we're going to listen to one more clip from the first chapter of Hillbilly Elegy, followed by an excerpt of my original interview.
Like most small children, I learned my home address so that if I got lost, I could tell a grown-up where to take me. In kindergarten, when the teacher asked me where I lived, I could recite the address without skipping a beat, even though my mother changed addresses frequently for reasons I never understood as a child. Still, I always distinguished my address from my home. My address was where I spent most of my time with my mother and sister, wherever that might be. But my home never changed. My great-grandmother's house, in the Holler, in Jackson, Kentucky. Jackson is a small town of about 6,000 in the heart of southeastern Kentucky's coal country. Calling it a town is a bit charitable. There's a courthouse, a few restaurants, almost all of them fast food chains, and a few other shops and stores. Most of the people live in the mountains surrounding Kentucky Highway 15, in trailer parks, in government-subsidized housing, in small farmhouses, and in mountain homesteads like the one that served as the backdrop for the fondest memories of my childhood. Jacksonians say hello to everyone, willingly skip their favorite pastimes to dig a stranger's car out of the snow, and, without exception, stop their cars, get out, and stand at attention every time a funeral motorcade drives past. It was that latter practice that made me aware of something special about Jackson and its people. Why, I'd asked my grandma, whom we all called Mamaw, did everyone stop for the passing hearse? Because, honey, we're hill people, and we respect our dead.
That was J.D. Vance reading from his book, Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. That audio is courtesy of HarperCollins Audio. Earlier this week, J.D. Vance talked with me by phone. So what do you mean, a culture in crisis?
Well, what I mean is that in a lot of different ways, I don't think things are going especially well, either for the folks who live in Appalachia, and especially the folks who migrated from Appalachia, what I call the Appalachian diaspora, who, like my grandparents, moved from eastern Kentucky coal country to southern Ohio and thought that they would find a better life. And as I write in the book, in some ways they did find that better life, but in a lot of ways they have really struggled. Their children have struggled. Their grandchildren have struggled. And I think you see it in various statistics, from family breakdown statistics, joblessness, higher rates of poverty, higher rates of incarceration, and, of course, this really terrible opioid epidemic that's really set in these communities and ravaged them in pretty significant ways. So what I mean is that I don't think that a lot of us are doing especially well, and I try to explore why that might be in the book and understand it a little bit better.
You talked a little bit about poverty and race in your book. Explain your take on perhaps the similarities, or why you brought up that in your book, especially in surrounding today's conversations that we hear.
Sure. So if you think about a lot of the conversations we tend to have around culture, and it's this concept that's really hard to define. It means different things to different people, of course, but often people use culture as a way to explain why poor people are poor or why poor people suffer from various problems. And that's certainly, I think is as problematic as culture has been used. I do think it's an important part of my story, and it's an important part of what's going on in these areas, that there are ways in which communities and neighborhoods make it a little bit harder for kids to get ahead. So having said that, I think culture is an important variable. One of the things I noticed when I was a kid is that culture was often used against black people, but not against white people. So you would hear people say, well, the black people have these various cultural problems, these various social pathologies, so we don't have to worry about them. They have to improve their own lot, and there's nothing the government can do. And I thought that was, one, really unfair. And the more that I took a hard look at my own community, at some of the problems I saw in my own family, I thought that it was not true. I thought that there were a lot of similarities between the problems of the black poor and of the white poor. And I thought that if we talked about the white poor and some of the problems that they have, we might be able to look a little bit more compassionately at certain black families and problems that they have, because I do think that there are a lot of similarities. I don't think the similarities are perfect, obviously. The African American community has a history of discrimination against it, which is important, and I think is at least different for a lot of poor white folks. But there are still a lot of similarities, and I think if we recognize those similarities, one, we'd be able to have a more honest conversation about how to help the poor of both races, but we'd also, I think, be a little bit more compassionate on the one hand towards black folks who are suffering from pretty extreme circumstances, and on the other hand from white folks in Appalachia and surrounding areas who are also suffering from some pretty tough lives.
Mm-hmm. One of the reviews printed on the back of your book says, quote, "To understand the rage and disaffection of America's working class whites, look to Greater Appalachia. In Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance gives voice to this forgotten corner of our country and to the millions of white Americans who feel powerless as their way of life is devastated," and then it goes on. But what are your thoughts about that? That's a pretty powerful statement and gives voice to this forgotten corner of our country. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it's very flattering, and I'm happy, of course, that the reviewer was willing to say such nice things. You know, there's this question about how broadly the lessons of my book apply. And I'm of the view that I think they do apply pretty broadly. And I try to back up parts of my personal story with anthropological and sociological evidence where it applies, because it's not just that this is something that's confined to Middletown, Ohio, or to even Southern Ohio, or just to Eastern Kentucky and the migrants out of Eastern Kentucky. I think that this is a much broader problem. A lot of these issues that I write about that are very prevalent in my own family. So what I think is true is that the people in this part of the world do feel very forgotten. They feel like a lot of folks on, a lot of folks with money and power don't really care about them, don't really think about them. And that does hopefully come through in the book. I write a little bit about how a lot of folks in my community started to lose their optimism about the future, started to lose their sense that America was a great country where if you worked hard, you could get ahead. I think that's a really legitimate feeling that's out there that people need to recognize and also people need to deal with, because it's not the case that the white working class is super happy with how things are going in the country. I think they're very frustrated and very worried about the future. And that's going to manifest itself in a number of ways, culturally, politically, and socially. There are a really big chunk of the people in this region. There is a big chunk of people in this region who are struggling in the way that my family struggled. And I don't think we do ourselves any favors by ignoring the real scale and scope of those challenges. Because if we ever want to help families like mine, if we ever want to make it easier for kids like me to get ahead, to live the American dream, we first got to be honest about what these problems actually look like. And again, hopefully I gave some portrayal in this book.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think that's, honesty and having this honest conversation. And it's difficult to have, because when you are honest about just telling your personal story, it seems that there's so many people who are quick to say, we're not all like that. And that's, you're stereotyping us. You're only perpetuating the stereotypes. We don't want people to think that we're like that. Stop talking about it.
And I will just say one thing, that I think it's totally fair that people are a little worried about being stereotyped, because it's one of the few regions of the country where stereotypes have been pretty well accepted. It's okay, as my grandma once said, to down on hillbillies and to think that they're all just a bunch of toothless rednecks. People do feel like that. And so I certainly appreciate that sensitivity is well placed. But I also think that we can't use the legitimate fear of being stereotyped by outsiders to not take sometimes a hard look at the folks who are struggling and to understand the ways that they're struggling. And that's all I've tried to do with the book. And I appreciate that you found something that you can relate to in it. And I'll say, I really appreciate you having me on. I've listened to your program a lot. And it's interesting to me, whenever I talk to somebody who comes from a more southern part of Appalachia, that they say Appalachia, which is what my grandma said. But all of us who grew up primarily in Ohio say Appalachia. So it's always good to have that kind of regional reminder. And nice to talk to you.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, J.D.
Okay. Thank you. Take care.
That was part of an interview I did with J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy, back in 2016, just after his book had become a bestseller. You can hear an extended version of that interview on our website at wvpublic.org. Appalachia has had an identity problem for a long time. It didn't start with Hillbilly Elegy. Stereotypes persist about what life is like in Appalachia. In movies, the people and places of Appalachia are often made into an other. The region is either romanticized or looked down upon. I mean, how many times has someone who isn't from here pretended to play the banjo riff from Deliverance when you've told them where you're from?
Appalachian stereotypes are the topic of a new book called Unwhite, Appalachia, Race, and Film. It's written by Meredith McCarroll, who is also one of the co-editors of Appalachian Reckoning, A Region Responds to Hillbilly Elegy. Our associate producer, Eric Douglas, spoke to McCarroll about how the stereotypes of our region get passed down in movies and how that affects those who live here.
Tell me, what prompted you to write this book?
I had the amazing experience of running into almost literally a reading of the Afro-Latian poets at University of Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And at that reading, I finally realized, oh, I don't have to think about race and region completely differently. At the same time, I was thinking about movies. I was thinking about the ways that movies represent places and was frustrated by the limited perception of Appalachia based on a handful of movies. So I thought, well, here's what I'll do. I'll go and I will blow up this idea that Appalachia is this monolithic, white, impoverished place and where all the same stories are told about this place as if it is this stagnant region. Fast forward, I watched a lot of movies. I was really building on Jerry Williamson's work that he's done about representations of Appalachia. And I, instead of seeing this wild diversity of representation of Appalachia, saw the same stories over and over that turned into these patterns of representation that allowed me to loop back in to thinking about representation of non-white people. And I started to make some comparisons there. Then I kind of got myself in an interesting situation where I wanted to be really clear that I do not believe the Appalachian people have been discriminated against in all the same ways as racial minorities in America. But the function of the lazy stereotypes is similar.
So the white people outside of Appalachia are saying, well, we're still better than everybody. Just ignore those people from Appalachia. They're not quite the same as we are.
Yeah, and I think that happens with representations of rural people, representations of poverty that sometimes intersects with whiteness as well. A lot of times, though, I think that those images of rural poverty get placed in the mountains, in the mountains south, and then something interesting happens where people begin to see the mountains south or even just all of Appalachia as one place that doesn't have diversity in terms of, you know, all of the ways that you can have diversity, class, race, politics, ways of thinking, religion.
Why do you think that Appalachia is portrayed that way? Is it just convenience? People want.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason that these stereotypes land on Appalachia has a deep history that has to do with, in some ways, it has to do with landscape. I think that people who settled in the mountains were able to. Many of them were more isolated. And that isolation was met sometimes with curiosity and sometimes with distrust. And so when people found their way from outside the region traveling through the mountains, I think that there was a curiosity that took on this dual nature with the way that Appalachian people were written about. At the turn of the last century, for example, it tended to be both this romanticizing perspective of, you know, Appalachian people were called our contemporary ancestors. So this idea that they're stuck in the past and that there's a romantic way to see that that way of living, because we tend to romanticize the past. But at the same time, there is something that there's this demonizing way of looking at people who are from the mountains, who are living in more isolation. And I think that the demonizing has to do with capitalism, has to do with the desire to have a place that you can take resources, take natural resources. So the extractive industries, of coal and timber, the ways that that the use of the land has been justified has to do with seeing the people living there as less than and other. And that happens both in sort of seeing them as quaint and of another time, but also as seeing them as, you know, there's something wrong with people who are living here, and so it's okay to flood their land, to take their trees, to you know, blow up their mountains.
What do you hope your readers will take away from the book?
I think ultimately I hope that people will look again at Appalachia and realize that the stereotypes that they see in these films are stereotypes, that they can't understand what it means to be in Appalachia by watching one movie or one set of movies. The Appalachia is an incredibly diverse place that spans 13 states, that is racially diverse, that has economic diversity, that is both urban and rural, that there's incredible activism coming out of Appalachia. That sometimes is missed if people watch a movie or two and think that they understand a place.
That was Meredith McCarroll, author of Unwhite, Appalachia Race and Film, and co-editor of Appalachia Reckoning. Unwhite is available through the University of Georgia Press. Today we've been taking a good hard look at why so many people have such strong feelings about Hillbilly Elegy. The story is essentially one man's memoir, and in it, J.D. Vance shares some deeply personal stories. He discusses the traumas of his own turbulent childhood, which is no small accomplishment. In fact, I imagine it's a little scary to put your life on paper like that for the world to read. He writes about his mother, who suffered from prescription drug abuse, about growing up in a home where unpredictability, chaos, and poverty were always present. These problems exist in many families, and unfortunately, too many of our friends and neighbors across Appalachia struggle with similar stories. These stark realities are what prompted Kelly Haywood to sit down to write her reaction to Hillbilly Elegy. Haywood was born and raised in Whitesburg, Kentucky. That's about an hour from Jackson, where J.D. Vance calls home. She called her essay In Defense of J.D. Vance, which was published in Appalachian Reckoning. Let's listen to part of what she wrote.
J.D. Vance is the product of colliding worlds, just as my community's Trump voters are. Yet his story is also readily identifiable as hillbilly. Vance's mother was raised by Appalachian parents who visited their childhood home in Breathitt County as often as possible, as many displaced Appalachians did and do. Vance himself spent a great deal of time in Jackson with his great-grandmother and his grandmother's siblings. Vance's writing or his perspective cannot therefore be discounted by saying his narrative is non-Appalachian. If you read the canon of much of popular Appalachian literature, you will find an often romanticized version of life, not unlike that of the Southern Moonlight and Magnolias literary genre. The reality on the ground is much barer bones and earth. Vance raises some hard questions, especially for those of us in the coal fields of Appalachia, who are facing the biggest upheaval our economy has seen in a very long time, with no tangible plans for how to fix it. All we have is the silver buckshot, as those in the region working in community development and just economic transition like to call the effort of throwing out many ideas to see which ones stick. Vance's book is a memoir. It is not his responsibility to write the experience of his critics or mine or yours. He has used his family's experience to give a human story to a class and region in crisis.
Haywood says she didn't necessarily want to support Vance, but she felt that people were spending too much time fighting over what he wrote. She says the problems Vance wrote about in his memoir, things like intergenerational poverty and substance abuse, are real, and we'd be better off spending our energy trying to find solutions to those problems.
I read the book before I heard anyone else's opinion, and especially for the first... or the parts where he is sharing his personal experience, the way that he grew up, some of the experiences that he had, I identified with it a great deal. And I found it almost refreshing that someone was actually talking about this stuff and not trying to romanticize it. Because so much of what we read about Appalachia in our literary canon, in my opinion, is very romanticized versions of what happens here. And while I felt like he was not romanticizing, I also felt the way that he wrote, I could also get from it a sense of a certain type of pride, too, that we as Appalachians all have in knowing that we have had these experiences and we can persevere if we so choose. And to me, that was something new, and it excited me because I could identify with it.
She was also concerned that people were trying to pick the book apart, suggesting his story wasn't valid.
I got frustrated because, one, it's a memoir, and I was seeing a lot of people doing things like saying that he wasn't an Appalachian, that he didn't know what he was talking about, questioning whether or not his summer visits to his mamaw's house meant he knew anything at all about the Appalachian experience. It seemed like they did not want to directly address the real, very real, true issues that the book brought up. And in my mind, if we're going to move Appalachia forward as a region, if we're going to have any hope at all for a sustainable future and an economy that is not coal-based, we're going to have to address these very, very stark and real issues.
Haywood says she doesn't want to place blame on why we got here in the first place, why the conditions and situations in Appalachia exist. She said it's important to understand that perspective, but it's not going to help us move forward.
What we have to do is learn from that experience and then use the resources that are available to us right now, because the coal companies are not going to come back in here and fix what they did. There's not the money there to fix it. There's not the impetus there. We've got problems that are disintegrating our communities right now that have to be addressed immediately. And to just place blame, and not do anything else to pick apart these issues with what we can actually tangibly do to start to address them right now in this moment, without any of the people who cause these problems coming in as players. If we don't do that, then we're just going to spin wheels. And again, we're not going to see any forward momentum.
Haywood points out that we're losing many people to drug addiction, and she feels like no one's talking about it in the way it needs to be discussed to make a difference.
I quoted a statistic from 2012 where 61% of people in eastern Kentucky felt that their kids would have it financially worse off than they have. That's over half of our population who doesn't see a viable future for their children. And in the same statistic, 1 in 3 people were quoted as having a family member or a close friend addicted to drugs. 1 in 3. So much of what I see is negating that experience and romanticizing our life here is directly in the face of those numbers. I want to find a way for those parents to become hopeful again.
That was Kelly Haywood talking about her essay In Defense of J.D. Vance in the book Appalachian Reckoning. Maybe Kelly's right. Maybe we shouldn't be so quick to dismiss J.D. Vance outright. There is something honest and vulnerable in his story. I can tell you that almost every stereotype of Appalachians is rooted somewhere in my people. I'm not denying that. I love them. Us. Anyway. I can relate to a lot of the situation Vance describes in his book. I'm not ashamed to say, yep, these are my people. But it seems as if his explanation is done in a predictable way. It's almost as if it's expected and accepted for people to talk about this region or the working poor in this way. In his book, he said the people who move away and go to college are often seen as getting too big for their britches. And it's true. Sometimes education is even discouraged. It seems he's gotten too big for his britches, and he doesn't care who knows it. I didn't graduate from Yale or Harvard, but I'm still proud of the degree I earned and know that it's greatly helped me in my life. For me, I'm finding more value in myself in my quest to stop simply surviving and start thriving, at least financially, thanks in part to my education. I don't want to get too big for my britches, as Granny would say. It's something we strive for on the show, too. Appalachians aren't always represented well in national media, and that includes public media. But to represent Appalachia well, you have to see it as a whole, warts and all. It's been interesting for me to grow up as a first person in my family to graduate from college. To stop myself getting too big for my britches, I often try to imagine how I perceived my life as a kid, or before going to college, or even before I got a job as a reporter. And I stay. I believe in the power of knowledge, education, and God. I'm finding that it's my faith that's helped me find balance and remember what's really important, my people.
Got that sweet mountain spirit down in my veins. And it flows through my heart like a mountain rain.
Before we go, I want to tell you about a project here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting called Wild Wandering West Virginia. We ask listeners to send us their questions. Then people vote online for their favorite, and we report on the answer. Maybe you can help us with our latest question. Wheeling, West Virginia resident Brian Joseph asked us to tell the story of the oldest mountains in the world, the Appalachian Mountains. This question won our online voting round, so we decided to visit with Joseph to gain a bit more insight into his curiosity. Glennis Board reports.
Joseph is an entrepreneur who has built a successful career turning Appalachian coal into material that is helping humans fly through the atmosphere and even reach into space. Given the chance, Joseph will happily rattle off a list of innovations and inventors from the region. And that spirit, he says, is shaped by the very old ground we stand on.
West Virginians live our lives separated by some of the oldest mountains on planet Earth. So when we actually go and touch some of these mountains with our hands, we're touching some of the oldest rocks in existence. And I think we take that completely for granted in West Virginia. We don't even know about it.
Understanding the lifespan of the Appalachian Mountains requires considering concepts like deep time, which is especially difficult for human brains to grasp. Consider that a bunch of millions of thousands of trips around the sun ago, all the continents were smashed together, and the Appalachian Mountains were like the Alps, reaching way, way, way up into the sky. Then, a couple inches a year, oceans grew between the continents. Now, that's tough to think about, especially since it was only hundreds of thousands of trips around the sun ago when we humans started traipsing around the remnants of these mountains, which, of course, have scooted all over the globe at this point, including, as Joseph points out, in Morocco.
So these are our sister mountains. They're called the Atlas Mountains. It would be interesting to just sort of, I don't know, go there and just think about how the geology there and the geology here and the difference in the latitudes have created different lives, different worlds.
A trip to Morocco sounds like fun and is definitely cost prohibitive. But we're a creative group, us Appalachians here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. So stay tuned. We'll be working on crafting the story of the oldest mountains on Earth over the next several weeks. Hopefully, this will be fun.
More on that story next month here on Inside Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Sydney Bowles at the Ohio Valley Resource, WMMT, and Apple Shop. Thanks to WVU Press for lending us excerpts, parts of Appalachian Reckoning, and HarperCollins Audiobooks for allowing us to use clips of J.D. Vance reading from his book, Hillbilly Elegy. Music in today's show was provided by Alan Cathead Johnston and Stacy Grubb, Tom Briding, Zach Bird and the Western Avenue String Band, Spencer Elliott, Dinosaur Burps, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He and Ibby Caputo edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.